Hi everybody, Will Alexander from Will Alexander's Dog Show Tips. This week in the interview chair we have Gavin Robertson from Soul Trader PBGBs. It was fun to catch up with Gavin, he's hilarious. Anyway, sit back and relax and enjoy a conversation with Gavin. Hi, everybody. We are here today with Gavin Robertson from Soul Trader PBGBs, judge of hounds and multiple other breeds and best in shows. Hi, Gavin. How are you?
I'm good, Will. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you.
This is the new life, looking every through our computer or our screen for the time being, isn't it?
Exactly. I'm not wearing pants, so.
That's too much information from the get-go, but neither am I, so we're fine.
A friend of mine worked on The Godfather when it was being filmed. He was security for Godfather. He told me most time Marlon Brando showed up without pants on.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I actually said the other day, I think I've forgotten how to tie a tie.
I
can't remember the last time I put smart clothes on, to be honest, you know? So, but yeah, that's the world we're in. But yeah, we're good.
At least you and I can cut our own hair, so...
Exactly, yeah. Nothing changes. I look the same all year round.
I had problems with the back for a while. I figured that out now.
So. Nobody can see it on the screen. You're fine.
Exactly. Except for what I've been like.
It's on ponytail. It's just drooping all the way down. You're good.
Okay. We'd better get started. It's good to see you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me, start from the beginning, Gavin. How did you get involved in dogs? And how old were you?
Okay, so really, I was a kid. My mother and father had a pet beagle, a real pet beagle. And when I was the youngest I can remember, it was fat and had one eye and a big, long, fluffy tail, and it was overweight. But anyway, that was the first one, and a German Shepherd, actually. And then we got a show beagle, which, looking back, wasn't great. But you start off with what you're given, and that kind of got us into the sort of bug. So I would go with my mum.
Approximately?
About 6 or 7. Okay. So, and then we would go to shows. I remember going to shows with my mom, and I would get to go in the junior handling and do little bits and, you know, get involved with everything. And so that kind of got us going in Scotland. When we lived in Scotland, we got the bug there of going to shows and seeing what it was like. And, you know, I got hooked almost straight away, to be honest. I loved it. Every weekend we'd go somewhere and we got very friendly with some other people in the breed who'd been successful or who were successful, and they helped us, and we had a litter, and we kind of, you don't know what you're doing when you first start. Oh, that looks nice, but on reflection, it wasn't good enough, but you don't know at the time. So we kind of muddled around for a little while, and then it was actually Andrew Brace, who by this point was a big judge himself anyway and still had beagles, and he said to our friends, Liz Kalikis and David Bradley, look, this kid that you're taking to shows, he's obviously got an interest, but he hasn't really got anything good enough. Is there anything you can help him out with? And they had a track band dog, and it had a litter, and they gave me this bitch. And that kind of started me on my own. And she was a good bitch. I mean, I didn't do any major winning with her, but I was 10 or 11, and, you know, but that got me properly hooked into it.
Sure.
And I went all around the country to shows and did the whole junior handling thing for a long time. But my key thing was, if I missed the junior handling, it doesn't matter. I want to show in the breed, you know, and I'd chat to every breeder there was, and people like Jill Peake, and she'd see, well, there's that little kid, you know. I was always bugging her. I could have helped her. I could have show a dog. But I wanted to kind of sap all their information out of them. And then I had a bit of a breeding program, and then I left home. And I started, and I thought, right, what am I going to do? And my father kept saying to me, you'll not get a career in dogs, you know, look for a proper job. And so I kind of resented against that, because I thought, I want to be a handler. That's what I want to do. And then I realized you can't really be a handler in the UK. It's not the thing. There's a few handlers, but it's more of a North American thing. So when I was, by this point, I'd left home and I'd worked at a couple of kennels, a very famous Shih Tzu kennel, Harapine Shih Tzus, Sadly, they're no longer with us. The very first day I was there, they said, "Oh, come and feed the dogs." And they brought a tray out, and there was 73 bowls on this tray. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I have two dogs at home, or three dogs, you know?" And I remember going around and helping feed all the dogs and learning through top knots and bathing and all that sort of stuff. And then I got approached. I can't remember how I got around to this part, but I wanted to find out what America was like. And by this point, I'd gone to another beagle kennel who had beagles and Tibetan Terriers, Mark and Judy Price. And we made a dog up, two Tibetan Terriers up, we made it up between us and showed some beagles, and we had a lot of fun. I was there a couple of years. But while I was there, we got set up that I came to America for a period of time. And I still, to this day, can't remember who it was, but who organized the whole thing. But anyway, I went to Brian and Nancy Martin in Chicago.
Okay, yeah.
And
what year was that?
Let's think. I would be, I'm the ripe old age of 47 now. And I went when I was, I think 19, 18 or 19. I was young, but I was very sort of a country boy. You know, I'd never been to a big city like that before. And my eyes were wide open. You know, I remember arriving on the 2nd of January in Chicago and Brian picking me up and driving me through the snow and getting to the kennel really late at night. And he said, "Oh, tomorrow we're going to Minnesota." "Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. How far is that?" "Oh, it's like an 8-hour drive." I'm like, "But it only takes 8 hours to get from the south of England to the north of Scotland. So but we're gonna go shopping first, okay? It's 11 o'clock at night." "Well, yeah, supermarkets are open all night." Well, not in England they were. So there's me, this young lad, going up and down the shopping aisle of Brian Martin buying car food for the road trip. And my eyes were like, this is just another world, you know?
Yeah.
And we get to Minnesota. It was so cold. I'll never, ever forget how cold it was. Our hotel was across the road. And my scarf, from walking from the hotel to the convention center, it was frozen. So when I got inside, you could literally undo the scarf in the knot of what it was. It was so, I'll never forget it. Never forget it.
That is cold there, you know.
Oh my God. In January as well. I'd never been anywhere before. I'd go there in January. It was a bit of a wake up call. But Brian and I showed dogs all weekend. I helped and showed a Basset, and Nancy went somewhere else. I think she went to Detroit or somewhere, the opposite direction. And I was there for, a couple of months. It was a trial to see if I liked it. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, you know, but I came back and kind of got settled back here, and they kept saying, "Please come out." And I was really torn because I liked it. And then it was a big commitment to move altogether. And I didn't go back. And I, in some ways, I kind of regret it, but that's the way your path steers you, isn't it, sometimes?
For sure.
But it was an amazing experience. And I still keep in contact from time to time with Brian and Nancy, and they were great, great teachers. And when I went to shows or afterwards, in years gone by, people would say, "Oh my God, but they're really scary people. Did you like, were you not terrified of them?" Like, "No, they were great. They were so easygoing, you know?" Nancy with her big fingernail, with the big nails on. And
yep.
Brian was into his music, and off he would go and really focus and show the dogs. But I loved it. I really, really loved it. Apart from the cold. I mean, I still now hate the cold.
Minnesota's
and it's nice, but it's nice to see Brian's now has gone off, and I see he's doing his license now for hounds.
Yeah, he'll be judging soon.
So that's good, you know. I'm pleased, but so that was my first sort of recall into what North America was like. But when I came back and I sort of ploughed on and worked for various other kennels, various breeds, and for a while I was working with Mike Gadsby in the Afterglow Kennel. I was there for a few years, learning about American Cockers and he had an Afghan at the time, and poodles as well, the early days of when they had the poodles. So again, that was a good learning tool, and picked up lots of sort of hints and tips and whatnot. So I've kind of spread myself around over the years, but in that time I had, early days, I kind of backtrack. I had my mother wanted another breed. And we went to Crofts when it was in London to look for a second breed. And the first day was gun dogs, and we saw the Italian Spinonis, and we thought, Well, they're lovely. They were very new. But we did like the look of them, but they were a different day and they were much bigger than what we were used to. So anyway, we marked that down as an interesting breed. And the next day, hounds were on. So we watched the beagles. And then after beagles was petite bassets were on. And they were, this is like 82, 83 maybe. So I was like 10. And there was hardly any. And they were literally like a fat, hairy basset with Queen Anne legs. They're nothing like you'd see now. And I thought, wow, these, but they had a face a bit like the Spinoni the day before. So my parents were like, why do you want a big dog when you can have a smaller dog that kind of looks the same? Now, I know now people will be horrified if they think they look the same, but when you're 10 years of age and it's new breeds, they look the same, you know, they do. So
they have a similar look. I get it.
Yeah, they do. They do, you know? So that was our introduction to getting the first PBGV. And she was actually the very first one in Scotland, this bitch. And she was well-bred. She'd come from a kennel who'd been informed a little while. Some had some stuff from Nick Frost, the new guy who's obviously in America now. So my mum kept a couple of those, but I then left home and I just had a couple of beagles. She kept the Petite. But I wanted to get back involved with the Petite. And for a little while, I was a lodger. I was a lodger in Ken Sinclair's loft, would you believe?
What is that? What do you mean a loft?
A loft is like the top part of your roof that's your house that's been converted. So usually it's got...
Oh, so that you were living there. Okay.
I mean, yeah, so I kind of rented a room out. So Ken... Where Ken was, and Ken's got his kennel name is the Iraqi Tibetan Terrier. So he's had Best in Show at Crofts, and he's had massive winners all around the world for years and years and years. He's a very successful and well-known breeder, and now he's a judge, but he's a well-known breeder. And he said to me like one evening, why are you messing around with those beagles? You know, it's such a hard breed to win with, and they're never going to like set the world on fire and group rings because they're against Afghans and they're not as glamorous. And why don't you kind of concentrate a bit more on the Petites? I'm like, oh, yeah, possibly. And beagles are a tough breed no matter where you are in the world, you know, and we can have a discussion for hours over what type you like, what size you like, you know, whatever in beagles. But wherever they are, because they're a breed of longevity and a lot of established kennels and breeders, people are very set in their ways of what they determine is correct or what they like in a beagle. And it's not easy. It's tough in this country to really break into beagles. So I thought about it a bit more. And anyway, to cut like a long story short, we then got a new Petite when I was up working with Mike at the Afterglow Kennel. And then that kind of got my teeth back into the breed. And that dog... We bought this dog and he was 6 months, he was 5 months and 3 weeks old. And he was entered at a show the week after. We bought him from this breeder, spent all day trying to convince this guy we could have this dog. And
how old were you then, Gavin?
I was now mid 20s now.
Okay.
Yeah, mid 20s.
I don't know the timeline with you and Sarah. Were you two already together?
Yeah, we weren't together. We've been together now 20 years. So this was a few years before that. I think 20 is correct. But she can't hear. So if it's wrong, we need to edit this piece out.
I'm not editing it. I just was curious because you said we bought this. When you said we, I thought you meant.
Okay, right. Yeah. So anyway, so I got this dog and we showed him the week after. He was already entered. The guy who bred him had entered at a show ready to go. And I took this dog, and the very first show he was at, we'd had him a week. He got reserve best male, or reserve CC as we call it in the UK. And like, wow, this is amazing, you know. And then he won another reserve CC like 2 weeks later. And that dog became a champion. And he was actually my very first group winner dog. He was a good dog. He had best of breed at Crofts. He was the first time I'd ever had best of breed at Crofts. And he then went to Helen Inger, the Charlin PBGVs in Florida, and she had Doug, and she got a few best of shows on him, and that dog was this before he left he was the sire, he sired a litter of the Woody Woodpecker dog that I had. That then Clint Livingston, and then a very young Janice Hayes, who was Clint's assistant, they took Woody on. Woody had done a lot of winning in a very short period of time in this country for him. And, you know, he'd won groups, and he was my very first Best in Show winning dog. Only the second petite ever to win a Best in Show in this country. Yeah, they took the dog there, and he won best. I think he got group four once at the Garden, and he was top petit a couple of times. And the funny story with that dog is that by this point, Sarah and I were together, and I've always wanted to show a dog at a breed national. So the national was on in Chicago. So we took the dog. The dog was already out there with Clint, and I said, the deal is, as long as I could show him just once at the national. So we got to the national, and this is my first real proper time I spent with Wendy Doherty from Canada, who's a mutual great friend of ours, you know, the funniest person in the world, she really is, as well as the kindest, but, you know, she's a great, great person. And so we were night before in the lobby. Wendy was down there showing a dog, and she had... she had a bitch, I think she'd had from Helen Inger down. And she had Jenny McClintock with her, who was handling. And she was going to handle her. So we were all chit-chatting away the night before. And I don't know how it came up, but Sarah and I had been together maybe, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years. I can't really remember how long. And they said, oh, if you win the national tomorrow, you'll need to marry Sarah. And I'm like, well, it's not going to happen because I'm not going to win the national. So I was like, yeah, that's fine. I'll take that bet on. I'm quite happy with that. What happens next? The next day, I win the national with Woody. So they were all holding to it. That's it now. There's no getting away from it. So I kind of, in one day, completed like a boyhood dream of winning an American national with the breed, that dog that I'd bred, and then committed myself to being married as well. So there's not many people that commit to things like that as much as I did. So that was the start. So yeah, and then I'd left the dog there, and they did a lot of winning with the dog, and that kind of, by this point I'd got more petits back home, and Sarah and I were living together, and that kind of started our journey of really homing in on the petits. I still have a couple of beagles. Sarah's not a beagle fan. She thinks that anybody who likes beagles has something missing upstairs. She doesn't understand it.
She's never told me that.
No, she doesn't understand. She thinks we're all warped. How can anybody like beagle? Because they're noisy and they can be destructive. But they're great. You know, they are a breed. And I know people in other breeds will say this, but everybody I've spoken to that's had a beagle, got a beagle. If you've had a beagle and then there's a period when you don't have a beagle, I will guarantee you at some point in your life, you will have a beagle again. That you just cannot get them out of your skin, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that was kind of how we got going, and really by that point, Sarah, she had done very well on her own, right? She had smooth collies and smooth collies, the first breed. In fact, she judged them at Crofts two, three years ago now.
Oh, wow.
She did them at Crofts and put up a lovely dog from Finland that was a lovely dog. And she had soft-coat Wheaton Terriers. And she's still the only, her claim to fame for that breed is she's still the only person in the UK that's had an all-breed best in show with a soft-coat Wheaton Terrier.
Wow, good.
So she made a few champions up. And she had a dog from Cindy Vogels as well that she did. And she did a lot of winning with over here. So we have no Wheatons anymore and no smooth collies, but she's still enjoys watching them, etc. It's just the teas we have now. And we kind of do that between us. Sarah doesn't really want to judge. She doesn't really like it. She's done it a few times and she said, I don't want to stand here and judge rubbish or be nice to people and then have to place them in order. I don't really like any of them. So she doesn't do that. She wants to carry on showing the dogs, which is fine. I like to do both. And I've for a while struggled with, should I give up showing because I want to judge, because I do enjoy judging. And we are very different in the UK compared to you guys in Canada and America, that you know, we can do both. That our rules allow that. You know, I can't judge one day at a show and the next day at the show another breed. But, you know, I can judge, as long as the dog's not my name, then I can judge at a show and Sarah can still show her dogs or my daughter's dogs. That's doable. So, but I do other breeds now, so I don't even be there on the same day as them. But a little peered out of the ring, you never lose that bug of having that buzz of winning in the ring, you know? So, it's just great. You know, if you've been fortunate enough to have had dogs that have given you some success, you know, I find it's like a drug, you know, the hits of the winning, the first win is massive and you'll never forget it. And it lasts for weeks and weeks and months almost, you know, and kind of the more you get, the more competitive you are and the more that hit lasts longer, that lasts shorter, should I say, you know, and it's, you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but you know, it's not, you're never unhappy about not winning, but there's times when within 2-3 days of a big win, a best in show, things like that, you're thinking about where's the next show? What can I do next? Whereas the first one, you know, I didn't care if I got beat for the next 6 shows. I was living on cloud nine.
Yeah,
you know?
Really. Yeah.
The first time when I had Woody had his best in show actually, and he was almost unbeaten in the UK. He'd won pretty much everything in the breed and group level and obviously a best in show. And the next week, he went to a show, and he was second in open dog. And the lady, bless her, who won the class, very nice lady, we still see her from time to time. She turned around and apologized and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I should never have beaten you." I said, no, it's not you, it's the judge's choice. And everyone's like, "You've taken this so well, but I was living on, I'd won the lottery, I'd just had a best of show, I didn't care." Maybe if that had happened a few years later, I might not have been as happy to accept defeat, but you know, you go out the ring smiling. If you're cranky, take it in the car. Don't do it at a dog show type thing. Yeah. So that kind of got me really into it. But I still dip over to America, and I've obviously been to Canada a few times, and we've struck up a very good friendship with Wendy, and we've had dogs in partnership. You know, I've been hugely proud and fortunate that you've had a dog and you've done extremely well with them, with Bjorn, bless him.
Bjorn is, yeah.
So, I mean, it builds friendships up, and then breeding programs help because you're working together. And so that's been a great part of the dogs, that you can have friends literally all around the world. We have a dog in Australia right now. And that literally came about, I was judging a beagle show, a big beagle show in Denmark, and my co-judge was from Australia. And we got chatting away, and we had this whole jokey sort of thing about, oh, well, an English beagle, we won't agree. And it was a 2-day show. So one day she did males and I did bitches, and the next day we swapped over. And then we did best in show at the end of the second day. And there was something like 200 beagles there. And we genuinely had no idea what each person had done. And when it came to best in show, her best male was my reserve best male. I think our reserves were slightly different, but our bitches were exactly the same. Same bitch, same reserve best bitch. So we ended up with 3 of the 4 out of 250. We'd found exactly the same. So we like struck a friendship, and she said, "Oh, that's really nice." And we've kept in contact, and I've judged in Australia and been to their house, and she's always wanted a petite. So she has a dog with us, dog with themselves now. So that would never have happened if it hadn't been for being involved with showing dogs and beagles, you know? So
hey, beagles.
Absolutely, yeah.
tell us about Crufts, winning Crufts with Chili.
Crufts was, everyone knows what Crufts is. You know, it doesn't matter wherever the world you're from, everyone knows if you show dogs what Crufts is. And it is the biggest show in the world, and it has so much history steeped in it. And especially coming from the UK, it's your, everybody wants to win it. In that people don't. There's 87 people that have won it. You know, it doesn't really happen. Somebody does it, but it's very rare. So it's always been a huge, huge ambition. And it is for everybody. There's some breeders who have done so much winning in dogs in this country who haven't had that fortunate experience. they deserve it, but they've just not had the luck or the timing. So we had this dog, Jilly, and she was out of a bitch called Associated Maya Fetisiak, who was the breed record holder. And it was a very good bitch, and she had group two at Crofts twice. And again, being in the group ring at Crofts, it's like being at Westminster or any big show. It's a buzz, you know, you love it. Those are the things, that's why you do it, for those moments. And it's so close to being winning the group, being second. And I've been very fortunate, so please don't think you're thinking I'm being sort of greedy or anything else, but having been fortunate enough to have won a group or groups and been placed, group second is the worst place in the world because you're so close to it. I'd rather be almost group three or group four or nothing at all, but group two, you're like, you can smell it. You think, oh my God, what if? Whereas if you're third, well, I've been by two dogs, you know, but one dog is so tough. And so I had a couple of group twos with this bitch, and she was a really good bitch, and she was a lot of people's favorites and for many ways. And we bred her, and this produced Jilly. And I'm not a huge believer in flogging puppies to death. We take them out, make sure they're happy, and they've got a nice disposition about them. But I don't want to overshow them week in, week out. And, you know, I'm a firm believer, today's top winning puppy is tomorrow's disaster, because you can just finish it. And why? Who wants to be known for having, I've got the top puppy? Well, in some ways, that means nothing, you know? So we showed her a couple of times. And then because of her age, the time when shows were on, she'd only been to two shows before Crofts in 2011. And Crofts is in the March. And in the January, I'll never forget it. I groomed her up, put her on a lead, and I walked up to the end of our drive and just a little farm road. And I ran her up on the show lead and back down on a show lead, and I said to Sarah, oh, we've got something special here. And she's, I think she's nice. So that was the January. And in the March, we took her to Crofts, and she was 15 months old. And she'd been to, by that point, that was her third dog show she'd ever been to in her life. And she went best of breed, won the group, and went reserve best of show under Paola Dondina, who from Italy, behind the flat coat retriever who had done a lot of winning. And it was her third ever dog show. And we were like, wow, you know, I've spent years being group two and so close with her mother. This bitch has been to her third show and just gone reserve best of show. And we were like, this is just unbelievable. So we showed her a bit that year, and the bitch just took off. She literally took off. That was 2011. 2012, she was the top dog in the country, and she had multiple groups and multiple best in shows. And we won under, a lot of people, you know, won under someone like Peter Green, which meant a massive amount. I've got a picture somewhere in the wall here of Peter giving her best in show. You know, that was a special moment in my career, winning under someone like him. And she won literally everything in 2012. Now, Crofts is a bit of a graveyard. It's known as a graveyard for top dogs. And it's very rare that the top winning dog of the previous year then goes on to go best in show. It's very rare. But there's a massive amount of media and hype and pressure. Oh yeah, Ginny's going to win. You're going to win. And that makes it tough because, you know, you're easy to fall down, aren't you? And there's a lot of pressure. You give yourself pressure, but there's outside pressure. And I genuinely didn't think it was going to happen. But we decided, because she'd won everything, really, that no matter what, Crofts would be her last show. If she got second in the class, she was retired. If I dare to believe that she could win, she would still be retired. Nothing was going to change. So It was a very emotional show because it was going to be the last time I was going to show her, no matter what. And so yeah, we won the breed on the, I think it was the first day, and which was great. And then the guy who was doing the group had already judged her before, had put her up. So I was really nervous because it's harder sometimes if you've already won under a judge, thinking, well, do they still like her or do they like something different? So he gave her the group, and then we had to kind of wait for 3 days to go back for best of show. And it was...
That'd be hard.
Oh, it was tough. It was Wendy was over here, and Wendy, Sarah took me shopping, that typical female thing. We went shopping, I bought a new outfit, for Sunday. So yeah, and then it came to Best of Show, and I was a bag of nerves. But the key thing is you've got to try and enjoy these moments because they don't come around very often, and try and memorize everything you can of that night. And it was on Best of Show judge was Jeff Corrish, who has been kind of my idol since a little boy. You know, the very first recollection I have of Jeff Corrish was when he showed for group captain and Kathy Sutton, showing the beagle, the Grad Cheese Hot Pursuit dog, Corky, who came over and was a big Best of Show winning dog. And I was 10 years old, 9 years old. I remember watching him in the stand at a show. First time this dog came out, wow, look at that. There's the top hander in our country showing a beagle. It's just at a Best of Show. It kind of blew my mind. And him and Michael have been, they are our top handers, and they've been so successful for so many years. And, you know, I have them, they're kind of up there as far as me. So to be shown under him is always nerve-wracking anyway, but to win is obviously even more special. So it was, it was an unbelievable experience and feeling, and something that nobody can prepare you for what happens afterwards. You know, it's like, you know, you've won lots of best in shows, and you win Best in Show, and then you turn around and everybody's packing up and putting stuff in the van, and we've got to get home before midnight, wherever it may be. What's it like? Sometimes it can be a big anti-climax. Well, Crofts is certainly not like that. It's like you win Westminster. You're on this journey. It's just like, but nobody prepares you for it. Nobody gives you any heads up what's going to happen, and you kind of just go with the flow. And I'll never forget the next morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, having radio on, asking for interviews and various things, and going on TV programs. And Jilly just took everything in her stride. She was just fantastic. She loved every minute of it. So easygoing, always wagging her tail. You know, she was the perfect picture dog for winning it for TV. They loved it. And yeah, that journey, there's not a day goes by where I don't think about it. Or in my shop, my reception area, we have a big poster of her winning. And there's always, once a week, there's always now. And that was 2013. Yeah. So there's always, it's 9 years ago now, 8 years ago, there's always somebody that'll mention it. And it was a boyhood dream that came true. You know, it was fantastic. And what I did from that, if I backtrack a little bit, they're as a breed, they can be quite naughty, and they're known for chewing and being disruptive. And she's got this thing about eating plastic. And she was permanently eating plastic dog beds and were forever taking plastic out of the back of her mouth. And
oh, jeez.
So tell you what, she's had two operations now over her years to take plastic out. That she, wherever she finds, if the kids leave a toy out or a plastic bottle, anything, she's chew. So she became a house dog by default, because when she was out in the kennel, she would just chew things. So I thought, we can't keep doing this, you know, having mouth being sore, all sorts of. But as a breed, they are very lazy. If they're not out and running around and getting exercise, they're quite happy sitting on your couch and do nothing at all. Lie in the bed, they'll lay there all day long. Well, she was a young dog. I needed to keep her in condition. So I started walking her every day. And I walked her 5 miles every day up the drive, down the farm lanes and all around. It's a 5 mile route, like a frog march, to keep this bitch in condition. And I did that through the whole of her show career, really, to keep her in order. So she became a house dog, and I had to physically walk her every day.
Good for you.
Yeah, kept me healthy as well. Yeah. So, but you know, literally, I never missed a day, like every day. And that, you know, between Christmas and New Year, I was doing it, and leading up to Crofts in 2013, we just didn't miss the keeper on top. And she was in hard condition, and I had lots of judges who commented out how good condition the bitch was, which, you know, that's important to me, the dog's well-being and everything else. So, but after we'd won, you know, she was retired. I said she was going to retire if she was second in the class, or she'd won. She won, she was retired. So we slowed down the walking. We didn't do it every single day because she's quite happy to do nothing, but I wasn't going to say nothing at all. But then afterwards, we kind of thought, well, all this publicity, what can we do? There must be something that I've got a very short window of she's the dog of the moment. What can we do? And just through thinking everything else, we came up with the idea that we do a charity dog walk. So we did a charity dog walk with Jilly, and it was called Jilly's Jolly Jaunt. And we walked from Birmingham, where the Ennis for the show at Crofts is, down this huge long canal, canal path. You guys know what canal is, yeah? Like a narrow river, yeah, with a towpath all down. And from Birmingham to London, it was 150 miles. And what I did was I got in touch with all previous Best of Show winners from Crofts and top dogs and well-known breeders and judges and clinical chairmen and various people. And they all had to commit to walking 5 miles with their dog. So we'd organized meeting at points. And myself and a lady called Amelia Siddle, who's got pointers, we did the whole walk. We did 150 miles in the week. It took us 5 days. And Jilly did 90%. There were some days where you're doing 25, 30 miles a day. It was a bit much. So she might have a break for 5 hours a bit, but she did the bulk of it. And we had some celebrities involved that came in. And we raised £49,000 from that walk. It was amazing for a children's hospital and in London, Great Ormond Street, which is a very famous children's hospital, and for the Kennel Club for their charitable trust. And then from that, we people like helping the media and the press within the dog world, and we set up a charity. So Jilly now, after all this time, she has her own charity, the Peekaboo Trust. That was her name, Peekaboo, Soul Trader Peekaboo. And in that time, we've raised now about 160,000 pounds now we've raised for charities over the years, and which is fantastic. I mean, that's a legacy for every. And then it's basically for dog people. So dog people raise the money, and we give it to children or dogs charities each year. We distribute different amounts. It was good. It went really well. And I find that show dogs can get a lot of negative press. And I don't know what it's like with you guys, but in the UK, we're very much reactive instead of proactive when it comes to pedigree dogs. And we always wait until there's something happening and try and react and cover ourselves instead of pushing ourselves out there and saying, look, these are healthy. You know, we're breeding dogs. They're healthy. Otherwise, they wouldn't be show dogs. You know, we're doing it all right, but people are quick to slam us. So it was a way of trying to promote pedigree dogs in a positive manner to prove that they don't all just live in a van or a crate or a treadmill. You know, they are physical dogs that we all love. You know, people forget that, whether you're a breeder or a handler or even a judge, we do it because for the love of dogs. So, and I don't think we promote that enough, to be honest, around the world. I really don't. The people on the outside, they can say that even you hear the word, it's a freak show. You know, you hear all sorts of horror stories, and it's not like that. You know, that it just isn't. So that was all off the back of Croft, really, because it gave us a platform to try and do something. And we've now set up every year we have our, we call it the Poskers, which is the top dog awards of the year, which is all, we've got a little committee that do that. And that's all raised money again for the Peekaboo Trust. And we have a bit like America do, where they have their top dog event the night before Westminster. And it's a black tie, and we raise money for that. Things like that have been a bit different than showing dogs or shoveling shit in the morning, as you do. Every now and then you can get dressed up and have a nice evening without any dogs and just mix with your friends and dog people around the country. So, that's kind of a fun part of what's come on from showing dogs and from winning, you know?
Yeah, that's a great, those are great ideas.
Yeah.
And it's something like that.
You did a lot. You've done a lot of great stuff. Yeah, people can do lots of things in different ways. I think anybody who's been fortunate enough to be in that kind of shop window for a period of time, wherever they've done, whether they've been successful or whatever it may be, I do believe that we can, if possible, give something back to help the next generation or to give positive vibes across to get more people involved in the sport. Because sadly, a lot of people are leaving, you know, through their lifestyle, through finances, through politics. Sadly, it happens around the world. People get disheartened, disillusioned, but it's actually, you can, it's a family, you know. We're never all going to get on, but it is a family and we all have the same core interests. And I think it's important that wherever possible, we try and need to give something back and help somebody. And I know you do a lot of your handling classes, and that's fantastic. You know, if you can help new people, and we have, you know, I've got a young lady called Lizzie who's now helping us with the dogs, and she's like a sponge. She literally wants to learn everything, you know, and she'll come up and she'll go over the dogs and talk pedigrees and breeding programs, and she's shown a dog, made a dog a champion herself in her own right, from one from us. And I get as much buzz now of watching Sarah or my daughter show dogs as maybe I do. And if somebody else shows a dog and wins, as a breeder, that means almost more to me than me going in the ring and showing it myself, because somebody else is doing it. And you've got pride in the dog you've bred. You get to watch it from the ringside and it wins. And that means a lot to me. So whereas 10, 15 years ago, I was like uber competitive. It was, I want to take them all in, and, you know, it's going to be my turn and I want to do this. And that's changed a little bit. I still like showing. I don't get me wrong. I'm not ready for hanging the lead up. And I do get a massive buzz when you've got something good at the end of a lead and you're fortunate enough to win. But watching other people gives me as much satisfaction now.
Yeah, so I'm in the same way. Like when I see my ex-assistants winning things, like Adam and even Jenny, and
yeah,
I love watching the win. It makes it's
absolutely
feels good, you know.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And you can't keep doing it forever. Not getting any younger, things start aching, things start falling apart, hands start hurting. So somebody else can do it.
Well, we haven't talked about, what's that?
Yeah, no, go on.
Okay, what we haven't talked about, who would you consider your mentors in the sport then?
My mentors, well, I would certainly have Jeff Corrish right up there. Just for what he's done and has achieved, and now I've got to know him, and I'd like to say I class him as a friend now. His willingness to pass on his experience and help is amazing. You know, he's helped me in little tips every now and about maybe grooming and things like that. But when you actually, and people will come up to him, and he'll help somebody with a brand new dog, a brand new handler, exhibitor should I say, with their dog, which really, between me and Jeff, it's not good enough, but they're learning, and he gives them encouragement. That means a lot to me, that somebody who I've got up there, who's won everything, has still got the time for new people in the breed. And that to me, that throws off the same for me. I want to try and help people because he can do it, and he's up there as one of the tops, then that's leading by example. Okay. He's up there. And then I would say, certainly, sadly, she's no longer with us now, but Marion Spaven with the Dial and Beagles, who was just an incredible lady and helped me from a little kid, her and the whole family did for many years. She taught me a lot about breeding, really. She, you know, I remember going and asking to use one of the stud dogs and asking to evaluate puppies. And she was very honest and very witty and funny. She had a great sense of humour. But she, one of the things she taught me, which was I'll never, ever forget, you know, she said, never be loyal to your own stud dog. And I'm like, what do you mean? She says, well, you know, you can have a top winning dog and you've bred it and you could have loved it and it could have done masses of winning. Just because it's got all those positives, if it doesn't produce, don't feel duty bound that you should use it. If somebody's got a better one, even if it's your best friend or your worst enemy, ask, because they can only say no. And that dog that you asked to use might be the key to producing a superstar. And I never forgot that. And it sticks with me. And I've heard some people making, in my opinion, a silly comment where they say, well, I want to use that dog because I bred it so that I've got both parents that I bred. Who cares? Like, seriously, who cares? Yeah. I don't care if it's two people that despise me that own both, bred both parents. If that can produce me something that's going to hit the jackpot, I'm fine with that. You know, I want to take something that I love, whoever's bred it. If I bred it, it's a bit of an icing on the cake, but it's not the be all and end all. So she taught me a lot of values and things like that, which was important. And then very much following, I'm very much a studious person of watching people and what they've done and looking up to them. And I don't know him that well. I see him once a year. We have a chat and he's had a dog from me to show. But, you know, people like Bill McFadden, I think he is the absolute epitome of professionalism and the way he conducts himself in and out of the ring. And, you know, that's such a huge benchmark for somebody to look up to see how he's doing it, how he's running his business, how he's looking after his family, how he is. He can have a laugh and a joke with him, you know, in these, where he's uber competitive and, you know, great handler, sympathetic, not over the top. You know, he's not one of these people that has to have the dog 10 yards in front of him and it's all about him. He submerges into the background and you notice this dog in front that's, wow, look at that. That to me is the value of a great handler, that you don't notice them, you know. And I think there's handlers now that are, they're too much over the top, you know, it's all about them, and that's not what handlers should be, you know. And it puts me off as a judge if they're shoving it in your face. If I like the dog, I'll see the dog. I don't need you pushing it in front of me, because let me tell you, the more you push it, the more I'm going to dissect it and I'll find more faults in it. So you're actually better
good way
back
of
it off.
That. Yeah. I might still.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, it really is true. You know, nothing's perfect. You keep shoving it. Oh, look at this. You realize, do you want, you're shoving it in front of me. It's got no forward chest. It's got a short upper arm and whatever else. You're being silly. You know, if you just left it as it was, I might have just gone over it and thought, well, it's moderate. Now you're shoving it in front of me. It's this, this, and that's wrong with it. So, if they think that fools some judges, great, but it doesn't fool everybody. So, so they're kind of people that I'd look up to. And then from a breeding thing, Nick Frost, he was my benchmark on a competitive side, because he'd won so much in the UK before he left to America, and he'd made up champion after champion. And I really wanted to try and emulate somebody like him. And I've been fortunate enough that we've now made up more champions than Nick has in the UK, not obviously what he's done in the States. And a nice sort of full circle is he now has a young dog from me that Clint's going to start showing. So after somebody who I've really looked up to and used the early dogs from and thought, well, you know, he's the sort of doyen of the breed, that it's nice that we're breeding working between us now. So that's kind of nice, I think.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah.
And so we talked about, we obviously talked about your biggest wins. We talked about your mentors. What about superstitions? Any superstitions, Gavin?
Oh, my God. I'm the worst.
Excellent.
I have a show lead and a pin brush that they had to go. They went through three dogs, Jilly, her mum, Dizzy, and her mum, Grace. And if I lost that pin lead, there was whole hell. Where's the pin brush? And using the lead. And so, yeah, no matter what, they were my thing. I'm not the sort of person who must wear the same clothes and things like that. I'm okay with that. Sarah, my wife, she was the worst when she showed Mike, Magic Mike, the last couple of years. And she was fortunate enough to go reserve best in show. And she was also top dog all breeds. She was terrible, like the worst, you know, because she had to wear the same outfit.
Can she hear you?
She's next door, she's telling it, but she knows. We all told her that she was a freak because she was obsessed. Same knickers, everything, you know. And if she won, her and Lizzie would come back from a show and they had to stop off, even though my wife's a bit of a health freak, they had to stop off and eat a Burger King, like a McDonald's. That was their celebratory treat to themselves. But because they did it and they won, they couldn't stop. So every time they won, they had to stop somewhere on the way home and eat a burger, because if they didn't, that might mean they won't win next week. So, I mean, proper, like, so the lead and the pin brush were kind of my only thing. The only time I got a bit of a panic on is when I was a very young lad, I used to just wear a pair of trousers and like a body warmer. It had all the club, Beagle club badges all over it, as we all did when we were all young. And a guy who's no longer with us said to me one day, look, you know, you can show a dog and everything else, but it's the whole package. You need to smarten yourself up. You need to get yourself a tie and a jacket. Okay, so I got rid of the body warmer that had literally every badge you can imagine all down every lapel, and had a little tie and a jacket and started. And I always wear a tie and a jacket. And I got to Crufts one year, and it was the year that Jilly was reserve best in show. So again, she was only a youngster, and I was showing other dogs that day anyway. And I always used to bring my show suit to Crofts, come in with a pair of jeans and unload and set up and then go off and get changed beforehand. And I took my clothes bag into the gents' toilets to get changed about 20 minutes before I was going to go in the ring. I left it too late. Typical me, talking to everybody that I've not seen for ages. Oh shit, I've not got changed. I ran in. And so I go into the men's cubicle and I take my top off, put the shirt on, undo, put the jacket on, undo the clothes bag. There's no trousers. And I'm like, oh my God, where's the trousers? So I quickly then put my jeans back on, ran out to a friend of mine who'd got a dog in partnership with us, and Paul, I need your trousers. So I said, what do you mean? I said, look, I can't find my trousers anywhere. I'm about to go in the ring. I cannot show a dog in jeans. I cannot. So quick, come with me. So we both went back in. I mean, talk about what people were thinking. We went back into the gents' toilets and we thought, all right, we can't both go in the cubicle. So we went into the cleaning. There was like a little room where the cleaning attendant had all her stuff. So I said, quick, get in here. So we both went into this cubicle. And as we both got our trousers down, the door opens with the cleaning attendant with a mop and whatever else. And there's two men with the trousers down by their ankles. I mean, you know, you can imagine. Anyway, she just turned around and disappeared very quickly. I quickly got Paul's trousers off him. He put my jeans on, went back in the ring, and then won. And I won best of breed. I had to wear Paul's trousers all day because I couldn't then change to then not show the same trousers in the group ring. So it wasn't really a superstition. It was just a story that, like, oh my God, this could be a nightmare. You know? Nightmare. I'll never forget it. And every year our ring at Croft is next to where this toilet is. Every time I go to the toilet, I walk past that tenant. That superintendent's probably not even there now. But every time I walk past that door, I think, I'll just keep walking. Keep walking.
That's funny. I have a story about us. We were at the PBGV National. I had Peter and yourself and Sarah came in to watch, I guess. I don't know, maybe you were dropping off a bitch. I can't remember, but you were there.
Yeah.
And we got to talking with Sarah. We were talking to you, and you pronounce aluminum aluminium.
Right, as it should be, aluminium.
I don't know if it was myself, but Wendy was there. Were we arguing about the pronunciation of aluminium, aluminum, and we had previously set up Sarah, and she went along with it. She was great, and you were going to ask Sarah how we pronounce aluminium in the UK, and she turned to you and said aluminum, and I thought you were going to blow a gasket.
I'll never forget that night because I was so like, you guys are all mad. This is Queen's English. It's aluminium. Like, it's not even up for discussion. It's not aluminium. That's the typical North American thing. You get the words and you change it to super. It's aluminium. So there's you and there's Wendy and there's a few other people there and they're like, no, it's aluminium. So I remember turning to Sarah and said, Sarah, please just tell these idiots that they're talking rubbish. It's aluminium. Please, Sarah, just tell him. And she says, it's aluminum. I'm like, what? What are you on? Are you on drugs? Are you missing something? You've never said it's aluminum ever in your life. It's aluminium. So then, to make it even worse, because you completely concocted this whole story, I didn't realise that she'd messaged a friend of ours, Susie, back home in England, who's, I mean, she's the same age as us, had dogs all her life, Irish setters, and really nice lady. And got a lot of time for her. She's the most honest person you're ever going to meet, you know, and she's lovely. So I said, I tell you what, I'm going to call Susie because I'm not having this discussion any longer. You guys are all whacked. You're wrong. Unbeknown to me, Sarah had messaged Susie and said, right, you need to go. So I'm calling Susie. Do me a favor. I've got these crackpots here from Canada and America. They can't even pronounce aluminium. Just tell me. And she went, it's aluminum. I'm like, oh my God, this is, I'm having outer body experience here now. Yeah, it was.
That was fun.
That story has gone around the world by so many people about me and aluminum, aluminium. It was funny, but I was just sucked in big style by it all. So yeah.
Sarah was great.
Yeah, that was good. That was a great national because that that national was under Betty Ann Stenmark, you know, famous.
No, that wasn't the same national. No, this was the one.
That wasn't the same national?
I had Peter there, and Peter had won the day before the Luke Ballou. The next day was Doug Johnson.
Oh, okay, right, okay. But when we were at the national, when Betty Ann Stenmark won.
I wasn't there. That wasn't me. That was Doug.
Oh, Doug was there. But you were there as well. You were there as well. Were you running the Doug show near as well?
No, I don't. No, Doug showed Bjorn and I showed Peter. Oh my God, how old are you, Gavin?
Oh, I know. That's old age. It's children and a wife and old age. It's making me lose my hair, everything. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, Betty Ann Stenmark, we had Bjorn with Doug.
Yeah.
And I had Donald Duck with Bill McFadden, who'd only just had the dog. And that's an amazing, amazing show we had there, because I can't remember what the entry was, but we ended up with Best of Breed, not Best of Opposite, but then we had all the award demerits, and we'd had Winner's Dog, that was it, Winner's Dog, Winner's Bitch, Best of Breed, and all the award demerits were all Soul Trader dogs. And she had no idea. I'd never met a lady in my life before, and went up to her afterwards, and she had no idea. But I mean, that was, as a breeder, that was an amazing day to win.
Didn't get any better,
literally, across the board, you know. So
you had the wrong handlers. You had them all mixed up.
Well, I know. Yeah, I know. That's an age thing. You're right. Well, you're right. So
kick out of it.
But it's still strange now, because you know we're living in this COVID world now where nothing's happening, and I've not been to shows and seeing people, and we have a bunch of nice young dogs at home that just haven't been out yet, you know, and they'll get the chance, I'm sure, but it's still the same work involved, keep it on top of them condition wise and everything else, and nowhere to take them. So I'm not saying I'm missing showing a dog. I mean, I enjoy showing a dog, but I'm missing seeing friends at shows and having a laugh, you know. It's because we're not professional handlers, but it's our hobby. You know, that's my day off. I go, whilst I might do long, long days going to the show and coming back, that's my day off, where I can show dogs, have some fun, see people I don't see very often. And I'm missing that really right now. And the same for judging. You know, I love judging. I love, especially in other countries where it's new dogs, and just to think, is the next class where there's going to be a superstar, or is the next class, you know, is that top winning dog I've seen that might come in the ring? I'd love to be able to put hands on it, see what it's like. You know, that's everything's on hold here right now, and in Europe, you know, the shows, I know there's some shows in America at the minute, but everywhere else is just, life's on hold. So
let's hope the ship gets righted this year and we get on with our lives. I have one final question for you, because I have to have a time constraints, but I can keep going. This has just gone by. It's been great. Great to see you. The last question though is, if you could meet the 20-year-old Gavin and give him some advice, what advice would you give Gavin?
Take the hair remedies quickly. Because at 21, it was nearly gone. What advice would I give if I was 20? That's a really tough question. I would say, what would I do differently, or advice? Do you know what? Let me think. That's a tough one. There's not a massive amount I would change. I'm really happy with everything that we're doing and where I am. And, you know, started from not a great deal to kind of have something that's important. Probably just, if I was 20, maybe ask more questions. I mean, I'm not scared of asking people, but ask more questions to learn more, because I think you can never stop learning. You know, I've watched a lot of your videos that you do, some of these breeders and long and high respected judges who are coming to the end of the judging career, and you can never stop learning, you know, never. And I think the more you can extract from breeders, exhibitors, judges, handlers, wherever else, if that's your journey, then the more you can learn, the quicker you can learn, and then hopefully the more fruitful it would be for you in wherever walk of life. So, yeah, I would say ask questions and have a laugh. You've got to smile through life. People, I don't know what it's like in Canada these days, but dog shows are getting almost too serious. You know, you should come, and if you're having a laugh outside the ring, people turn around and they look at you and say, oh my God, they're laughing. You know, yeah. You're meant to have fun. You know, that is why we do it. It's a fun hobby. Win or lose, you're taking the best, in your opinion, you're taking the right dog home with you. If you don't win, there's always another day. You know, a very famous judge who, again, sadly is no longer with, Hans Lettinen from Finland, who is one of the world's top judges. I mean, so respected, and the knowledge that man had was incredible. I remember going to Helsinki watching, he was judging the Alaskan Malamutes, and I just walked by, saw he was there, watched the class, he came over, oh, nice to see you again, and he very quietly spoken man he was, didn't man of little words, but very choice words, and I remember in between classes, he'd come and talk to me about the previous dogs in the class, and then that, I know, our period I was there, I learned so much on Alaskan Malamutes. Now, that's not my breed, never had one, don't particularly want them, I can admire them, but the little snippets he gave you was just incredible. And he was a great mentor, and I've lost my train of thought now while I was on to Hasse now. That's a sign of getting old, that you can't remember why I went on to there. Oh dear, no, I am losing it now. I can't remember why.
We were talking about advice.
Yeah, and he was very good at giving select words.
We were talking about, we started off about talking, what advice would you give Gavin? You were saying your answer was to learn more and ask more questions. That's how you got on.
Yeah, and we lost him too soon. He was a tragedy. He was a very, very, so much work he put into his judging. You know, he was a terrier person at heart, but he was so underused in so many countries. I mean, he was judged all around the world, but he was just an incredible guy, really, you know?
Yeah, we don't get him like once every couple of years, so.
Yeah. No, you'd always pay your money to show under him for his opinion. You know, it meant a lot. You know, there's some judges you'll show under because they know they're good with the dogs. They'll handle them well. They're not going to panic them. And there's judges who you value their opinion. And I've people like him, I've won and I've lost under him, but I still value his opinion because he had a memory. He would say to you, well, I didn't like X and Y. And he was bang on right. You know, I might not have been happy I didn't win, but his remarks were bang on for that dog. So you couldn't complain. You know, it was his opinion. He placed him in order of merit and I could see what he was looking for. And to me as a judge, that's all you can ask for.
I agree.
Definitely. So
anyway, I'm going to have to let you go because I'm going to get past our time here and the powers that be.
Too much. You might need subtitles for all these people in Canada because you've got this mad English Scotsman who talks so fast.
Well, we can understand you. It'll be the Americans. You watch.
Yeah, because they change all the words. They change all the words. Bloody aluminum. And color. Spell color. C-O-L-O-U-R. O-U-R. Go to America. They've got no time. They take out a U. What's all that about?
It's true. We get in the same arguments. Oh, they'll think I spelled something wrong.
Absolutely. But I'm so looking forward. I've not been for a few years. I'm so looking forward to going back to Westminster this year. Hopefully it goes ahead. But I mean, I've heard that this venue where it's going to be for this year is fantastic.
Oh yeah, it looks just beautiful, doesn't it?
And it'll be so different from being at the Garden, you know, in a nighttime in New York, and you know, it'll be an experience. So yeah, hopefully that'll go ahead so I can catch up with some you guys and everybody else. But
I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Even if we've got to wear the masks or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. But all right, Gavin. Well, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, take good
care
to see
of my
you. Yeah.
Love.
And, yeah, I will do.
Hopefully, I'll see you in New York. It's still New York, so
it is. Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah. All right, take
Gavin.
Care.
Take care.
Thanks again.
Bye bye.
Told you. If you like what you see here, make sure you press the like, share, and subscribe button. If you want to get a hold of me, get a hold of me at dogshowtips@gmail.com. If you just want to find out what's happening in Will's world, go to willalexander.net. Until next week, guys.